Welcome to the Creative Pen Podcast. I'm Joanna Penn, thriller author and creative entrepreneur, bringing you interviews, inspiration, and information on writing, publishing options, and marketing ideas for your book. You can find the episode show notes, your free author blueprint, and lots more information at thecreativepen.com. And that's pen with a double N. And here's the show. Hello, creatives. I'm Joanna Penn, and this is episode number 328 of the podcast. It is Friday, the 30th of June, 2017, as I record this, a little early again because I'm doing an ultra marathon tomorrow. Yes, this time last year, I said I'd never do it again when I did 100 kilometres in a weekend, but I madly registered for another one, although this year I'm only going to do the 50 kilometres in a day. So tomorrow I will be walking the Cotswold Way. Actually, it leaves out of Bath, which is quite handy, so I don't have to get up so early. And I'll do the 50k, and then it will seem very easy compared to the 100k, I think. but I would have actually done the Race to the Stones again, except I'll be in New York while it's on, or it's the week after or something. So I thought I'd try this one. But next year, I think I would like to try the 100K again. I know so much more about how to deal with it. And I think, you know, I want to give it a go and see if I can do better than coming last. So if you were listening to the podcast last year, you'll know I talked about that. Anyway, today I have an interview with Sean Black, an Irish writer who's a lot of fun, and we talk about the roller coaster of traditional and indie publishing and Sean's journey and experience with each, and you'll get some laughs along with your interview and Sean's lovely accent. So in publishing news this week, excitingly, Publish Drive have announced their advanced pricing feature, so you can do multi-currency pricing, and this is what I've been waiting for. And I will be publishing on Publish Drive in the next week or so. Obviously, I have quite a few books to get loaded up. I've been waiting for that in order to get onto Google Play and also to start tapping into the Far East markets, China and other Eastern European ebook markets. Remember that the big players are not the only players. And although some of these sales might be small on the other platforms, it can end up being a significant stream over time. So I'm really interested in what Publish Drive are doing. What's, I think, very good is that they are a Hungarian company, so they are not facing some of the prejudice that the American companies face in the Far East. So may well sort of, you know, get a bigger hold in those markets. It's early days, but I'm certainly interested in that. So check out Publish Drive and their advanced pricing feature. Also, kind of in publishing, I've had three people in the last week tell me that they've been listening to the podcast for years, have not yet published an ebook version of their book. So I just thought I would sort of challenge everyone listening. If you are not making enough money with your book sales, do you have an ebook available? And is it priced at a good price for the market? And if you haven't got your ebook sorted, or maybe you have an ebook but not print on demand, please do check out my free ebook on successful self-publishing, which is free on all the various stores. Because if you don't get these basics right, all the marketing in the world won't help you. So, you know, one example was someone who was sort of aghast because they weren't making money on their Facebook ads, but actually they didn't have an ebook, they didn't have a proper cover. And at the end of the day, the marketing basics are still, you know, the fundamentals of having the book available on different platforms, in specific formats, and optimizing things like cover, sales description, etc. And it's really well worth revisiting these basics, as I've done recently for How to Market a Book 3rd Edition, which has been a lot of fun. I'll come back to that in a minute. So futurist stuff this week, I'm actually going to take you back and try and see if you can do a thought experiment for the next 10 years. So June 29th, 2007, the first iPhone was released. And I want to sort of ask you to look back over the last 10 years. I didn't get a smartphone 10 years ago. I think I probably got one around 2009.
But certainly I wasn't an early adopter. I was like, why do I need one of those? My phone is fine. And I had one of those, you know, old Nokia just text only type of phones. But obviously now it's an extension of my arm like everyone else. So just consider how much your own consumption behavior has changed since you got the smartphone. You might even be listening on your phone right now to this podcast. Think about your reading behavior, your listening behavior, your internet search, your buying, how you buy stuff, and how you remember stuff, your to-do lists, your calendar, your social connections, your messaging, and then extrapolate that to the rest of the world. Because most of the world doesn't have a smartphone, but in the next 10 years, smartphones and streaming internet will be everywhere. So by 2027, they will be everywhere. And so that's what's exciting me. And I do talk about this quite a lot, but I hope that it keeps inspiring you about the future and about the potential with these growing markets. I'm actually reading an investment book right now called How to Own the World, A Plain English Guide to Thinking Globally and Investing Wisely by Andrew Craig, or Craig, as Americans say. And it's really interesting because his points about investing in different markets reflect my own feeling around global business and global growth. And this guy's like one of those super amazing people. Whereas I just have opinions. It's interesting because, you know, he talks about in the book about the massive growth that's occurring in developing economies, growth, which in the West, we don't have growth like that anymore because we've had our massive growth spurt and these other countries are kind of catching up. So it's really interesting to think how the shifts are happening in the world and how what's so brilliant is we can take advantage of it now. So also just on the investment side, I do want to have a podcast about this at some point because I've talked to a number of, I might do it after I've been to Oregon in the fall or the autumn, Northern Hemisphere autumn, you know, because it's something I'm thinking a lot about in terms of investing the money we make with our books in order that we don't have to stay on the rat race of producing more content all the time. So I'm thinking about some of those things, which is obviously great to be in that position. I know many people are still just thinking about cash flow, but it is fascinating to think of how investments changing, how smartphones and streaming internet and consumption is changing. So interesting stuff. So my personal update this week, it's been a big week for finishing energy, which I mentioned a bit about last week. I spent 24 hours in London and I got powered up with my fix of culture and a few gin and tonics with author friends. I actually visited the Hardy Tree. And those of you who are interested, it is based on Thomas Hardy, the English literary author of Far From the Madding Crowd, Jude the Obscure, A Tess of the D'Urbervilles and other books that you might be familiar with. Now, Thomas Hardy, when he was a young man, actually worked for the railway. And part of his job was relocating some of the graves and the bodies from St Pancras Old Church when they were building St Pancras Station and they wanted to put the train tracks through this area. So what he did was he moved some of these bodies and gravestones and sort of planted a tree and put these gravestones in a pattern around the tree. And St Pancras Old Church graveyard, you know, has this now mature tree with the gravestones around it. So very, very cool. And I'll link to that in the show notes so you can see a picture. If you follow me on Instagram and stuff like that, you'll find that I'm JF Penn Author on Instagram. I finished proofing How to Market a Book, third edition, in audio format. So that will be out in the next few weeks. Can't entirely control when ACX release that, but that will be going out. And I will be doing non-exclusive rights with ACX in order to use the new service from Draft to Digital and Find a Way Books as well. So I'll definitely be doing that. The launch date is this week for the ebook and print editions. And some of the eagle-eyed of you have already found and the Create Space version, which actually is up already. The launch date is 6th of July for the ebook and print. So this week you can get it. If you got the 2014 edition, this has a load of new stuff, which is why it's a different version. I didn't just upload a new version. So it's a new book. It includes chapters on the polarities of marketing, which is something that I think is quite a powerful way to reframe marketing in general and see where you are on the scale, as well as how to market print books, how to market audiobooks, plus paid ads, platform building, and so much more. It's actually quite a magnum opus as such. Many of the books on book marketing are quite short. This one is pretty decent size and, you know, is an attempt to cover a lot of different things. So available 6th of July in ebook and print, coming soon in audio. And of course, if you find it useful, I'd really appreciate a review on whatever platform you bought it on. I've also published the second book in the Sweet Romance series. So I have two out now with more planned, and my mum is just delighted with the whole experience. It does make me rather grumpy to edit romance. So I've also been diving back into my more visceral thrillers this week and the new fantasy series I'm working on. But the Sweet Romance is great because it does make my mum happy. And actually today, the last day of June, I will be paying her first royalty check. And that's a big deal. As you know, it's a big deal for any author to receive money for work that they have done. And so, yeah, I feel really happy because, you know, you want to help your family, but you can only, you know, you can't hand out charity a lot. But by helping my mum do this, I feel like, well, one, she has a new purpose as she hits 70 this year. And also she's delighted to be earning money again. It's interesting how earning money for our work does provide a sense of fulfillment, a sense of self-esteem. I think money is important. And of course, creating for the sake of creating is important. And I am actually only paying her not very much money for the couple of days in April the book was available, but it's something, and that's important. So even, and I was again looking back at my earliest months, I think it was something like June 2009, I made $10.21 or something on Amazon. That was the total of my book sales income in June 2009. So I hope that encourages you. If you're making your first $10 or your first $1, then if you keep going, you can do pretty well over the long run. Also, on the dictation, as we talked about last week, I'm actually rocking it now. I think I've turned a real corner. What I did is just focus on transcription rather than having Dragon write as I talk. But when I did that and when I looked at the words appearing on the screen, I was just always correcting them and sort of stuck in that editing space. But what I've been doing is I've got a very small Sony dictaphone, you know, like one of the old dictaphones, and I've just been speaking into it. I haven't even been using any punctuation. I've actually been paying a transcription service, speechpad.com, who also do the transcription for the podcast. And that has really helped. So I did 3,500 words in 40 minutes the other morning, which is awesome. And it's not bad for a first draft. And it's interesting. So now I did that for the first couple, and yeah, it's expensive, right? But what I'm now doing is I've just started to put full stops or periods at the end of the sentence. I'm still not doing speech quotes or commas or anything. I'm adding those on when I do a sort of light run through after the transcription is done. But now I'm using the Dragon transcription tool, and it's pretty good. So I'm very excited. This has potentially changed my process big time. And I'm loving it because I very rarely have done 3,500 words in a day, let alone 40 minutes. Although it was probably after the 40 minutes was dictating it, and then I did a light edit. But, you know, 3,500 words in an hour or 2 hours is pretty good for me, to be fair. And I'm thrilled. So I'm going to start with this process and see how fast I can get this first draft done. So I'm at 25,000 words on the map book, which I'm still not ready to talk about in more detail, but it's really an interesting process. So, and hello to Kevin J. Anderson, who has been on the show before, talking also about his dictation, and he listens at the gym. So morning, Kevin. And Kevin is one of those people who does dictate while walking out. He goes for hiking and things, and then he has somebody who transcribes it. So I think that if you're someone who wants to do dictation and you're struggling with the whole dragon thing with speaking and watching it on the screen, then walk away from the screen. Take your little dictation machine and try doing it with the transcription side of things. Okay, we are also halfway through the year, and everyone just go, ah, because it's time to review our year's goals. Oh, I know you've been looking forward to this. Come on. So think about what you decided that you wanted to achieve in 2017. What did you decide for the 1st of January? Now, every year I post my goals on the blog and I went back to have a look at them. So I hope that you wrote these down somewhere. If you haven't, I urge you to do that now for the next 6 months of the year, because we still have half a year to go and you can achieve lots in that amount of time. So just having a look at my goals, just to keep accountable to you guys, I promised my nonfiction audiobooks, and I'm certainly delivering on that, and had my best audio income month last month, you know, based on the nonfiction audio. So I'm really thrilled about that. I did start Curl Up Press and have been happily using Ingram Spark for extended print distribution. And I've heartily embraced print as a bigger part of my business. And although one of the things I did say I would do is a hardback premium journal, which I decided against because the money just didn't add up. And my standards are very high around journals. I use Moleskine and Lookterm journals, and I just couldn't get a product that would equal those in quality and for a decent price. So I decided to ditch that goal. And this is an important part of goal setting. You are allowed to change your goals. And, you know, obviously things change, but if you don't aim for anything, you're unlikely to achieve anything. So I promised 3 books in the Sweet Romance series this year, and we have 2 out already. So I think we'll actually have 4 by Christmas. And we're planning an extra one for the Christmas promotional season. Why not a Christmas wedding book? You know, why not? I will also probably announce the Sweet Romance pen name by the end of the year. It kills me not to talk about it. It really does. And also I will probably be using a photo of me and my mum together. It just feels odd keeping it a secret. Although, of course, if you are a Sweet Romance reader, you can email me at any time for a review copy and I'll send you it so you can find it out. But only if you're a Sweet Romance reader. Do not email me if you read horror. We are getting to grips with intellectual property rights. Jonathan's done some courses on publishing contracts. And in fact, yesterday we read a contract together and went through it in detail. And it's fascinating. I feel that we are upskilling in the intellectual property right arena, which is cool. End of Days came out January. American Demon Hunters Sacrifice came out, the 4-author collaboration I did on the train from Chicago to New Orleans, which seems like a long time ago, although it was only March a couple of months ago. The pilot for the London crime thriller TV adaptation is still being worked on. I decided not to launch supernaturalthrillers.com, but instead I focused on adding content to jfpen.com, and I will be redesigning that site to reflect a more content-focused approach. I think, especially with this new trilogy for the map stuff, which is, it's basically fantasy. You could still call it supernatural thriller, but it's fantasy. These books are, you know, there's a magic system. So it really is. And my writing is so relentlessly cross genre. So I just have decided that I will do more content and attract people like me in a way that I'm used to doing. So I might even be doing more audio for JF Pen, you know, having like, a dark focused podcast or something like that. I don't know. I'm still thinking about it, but the Creative Pen has been successful for me in terms of content marketing. So definitely something I'm rethinking about for fiction. I also put on my list that I would schedule more headspace. And this has actually really sort of come true in the last 24 hours when I decided not to pursue what would have been a lucrative opportunity, but an opportunity that would have taken a lot of my headspace. And I really do want to focus on writing. And I can see from the 6 months of the year already that I've put out a lot of intellectual property assets already. And if I distract myself with other projects, then I won't be able to write so much, publish so much, and, you know, hopefully help you guys as well. I'm also doing a lot more yoga and sort of 3 times a week now, and it's really helping a lot with my physical self. And today I'm also 40 days sugar-free. And that is helping too, because I had got to the point where I was just ODing on sugar, and that was not good for me. So yeah, I'll be writing more about the whole sugar-free thing and yoga. I am co-writing a book on sort of the healthier side of being a writer, or the trying to be healthier side of being a writer. More on that later this year. So that's my half-time update. So what about you? What did you decide to achieve in 2017? How far through those goals are you? What do you need to do to ensure you reach your target? And maybe write down a few things that you're going to get done in July so that you are one step closer. Also, happy 4th of July to all Americans this week. And if you need to escape your family, or if you just have the extra time, it's the last call for the Dark Crime Mystery Thriller Bundle, which you can find at storybundle.com/mystery, with multi-award-winning, uber best-selling authors, full-length novels, some short stories, really awesome pay-what-you-like deal, includes my novel Desecration, and much more. So check that out at storybundle.com/mystery. Okay, thanks for all your emails and tweets and comments this week. Moralva Guzmao says, listening to my favorite podcast while visiting the Temple of Literature in Hanoi, Vietnam. It sent me a gorgeous picture. And I presume you're listening to this show, Moralva. No, that's awesome. Amy Cesari is watering the sunflowers. Lovely picture. Kevin Switage about Dan Blank's interview said, this was a great podcast for any up and coming nonfiction writer. Thanks, Kevin. Anna Proofing said, listening while doing Viking kit repairs ready for the Wellingborough Carnival on Saturday. Viking kit repairs are pretty cool. Caroline Orchid says, full of renewed enthusiasm after listening to some of the podcasts. I can do this. Yes, you can, Caroline. Indeed. If I can do it, you can. Georgina Cross, binge listening to the show from Huntsville, Alabama, inspired by your canal walks and wanting to do the same. Helpful breaks between writing, and sent a lovely lake picture at Hampton Cove. And absolutely, Georgina, I think if we're going to make this a full-time, long-term living, we have to keep our bodies healthy. Anthony Young says, the podcast with Tim Grohl was brilliant. Your podcast archive is an international treasure. Thanks, Anthony. Diana Gunn, listening to the show on dictation while doing my own RSI exercises. Just a couple more. Chloe Wilson says, listening while running through Cataract Gorge on a frosty Tasmanian morning. I love that. So we've got Tasmania, Alabama, Vietnam. We've pretty much gone around the world with the podcast. I do love that. And if you're listening in a country that I have never mentioned, please, please, please tweet me or email me. I want to know. Joanna@thecreativepen.com. Oh, and finally, hello to Barry Pearman in Auckland, listening on a cold winter's morning with a woolly hat on. Bruh. Okay, so today's show is sponsored by Kobo Writing Life, and I'll play a word from our sponsor in a minute. This corporate sponsorship pays for the hosting and transcription, but my time in producing the show is primarily sponsored by you guys. So a big thank you to all the people supporting on Patreon. Thanks to new patrons this week, Nicole Burnham, Lucy, Donna Jean McKinnon, Jack Schaefer, Matt Heron and John Kilgallen. Thank you to everyone and to all the supporters on Patreon. I really appreciate it. Like the tweets and emails, you demonstrate you want the show to continue, and we will. We will make it to episode 400. Yes, we will. So on Patreon, you can support the show with a couple of dollars a month. Less than a coffee a month, or a couple of coffees if you're feeling generous, and you'll get the extra monthly Q&A audio, which I will be recording in the next week. So please add your questions on the form if you are a Patreon supporter. If you join as a supporter, even just for $2 a month, you will get the backlist of extra Q&A, lots and lots and lots of interesting questions and answers from listeners. If you are a Platinum supporter, you should also have the ebook version of How to Market a Book, third edition. So have a look on the feed if you are Platinum. You can support the show at patreon.com, patreon.com/thecreativepen. Right, here's a word from Kobo, and then we will get into the interview.
Hello, creatives. This is Mark Lefebvre, Director of Author Relations at Kobo. Because you're a Creative Pen listener, chances are you already know Kobo is a global company. But did you know that Kobo has merchandisers around the globe creating unique web store views in major global territories? Did you know that we have special features on local authors in those territories? Similarly, the top 50 bestseller lists and the category rankings on Kobo are unique. So we have about 17 different bestseller lists. And due to recent improvements on Kobo.com, you can actually see how your book is ranking in a territory other than the one you live in. So if you're looking at your book on Kobo, what you want to do is go to the very top and click on the country flag, which will probably be showing the country that you were viewing our website from. And that will bring you to a page that basically allows you to check from 18 plus different countries. So if you're an American, you can see what your book looks like in Canada. If you're in the UK, you can see what your book looks like from Australia, etc., etc., etc. This is handy because it can help show you what your currency looks like, so you can take advantage of our ability to set prices in 18 different currencies. But you can also see, if you happen to be selling really, really well in those territories, just how well you're ranking there. That's just one of the improvements we've been making at Kobo. We're going to be making more. You can find more tips like this at KoboWritingLife.com. Looking forward to seeing you there. And now back to your host, Joanna Penn.
Today, I'm here with Sean Black. Hi, Sean.
Hi, Joanna. Thanks for having me.
Oh, no, it's great to have you on the show. Just a little introduction. Sean is the best-selling author of the Ryan Locke thrillers and co-author of the Malibu Mysteries with Rebecca Cantrell, as well as the Byron Tibor series with Stephen Saville. Now, Sean, it's been ages since we arranged this, and I'm excited to hear.
I know
about what's going on with you. So start by telling us a bit more about your publishing journey from traditional publishing to indie and how you got into this thing.
Okay, I'll explain this, and I'll try and speak slowly for your American viewers.
Oh, everyone loves your accent.
Okay, I was wondering if this would be the first Joanna Penn podcast that had to have subtitles.
Oh no, definitely not.
You think we're okay? Okay, so I started back in, let's see, and sold the first book to a traditional publisher in 2008, and I had the kind of the dream start, you know, like the fantasy start, because I sold that book lockdown at auction for kind of mid six figures.
Nice.
So it was quite a strange, it was a particularly strange experience, because I was really broke at the time. I'd been writing television, and I kind of quit writing TV to concentrate on writing the book, because like a lot of people, you know, you, especially if you've got a day job, I know how it's difficult just to have, it's not even necessarily the time, it's just having the space in your head, to, especially when it's your first one, when you haven't done it before. So by the time that book went out, by the time I'd kind of finished it, and it was one of those books that I kind of threw, like, it's completely over the top book, because I thought, I'm not writing another one. like this is it, or it's going to take me a few years to recover. So I kind of threw, like, everything on the kitchen sink into that book. And got an agent, and actually had an offer from a couple of agents and was going to go with one, and then was talked out of it by the agent that sold it, who was a guy called Luigi Bonomi in London. And I remember he kind of kept me on the phone until I promised not to sign with anyone else. So he was very persuasive, and he was so persuasive, I thought, well, he's got to be the guy to sell it. So the way Luigi works was a kind of classic auction situation. He has a table at the Ivy in London, which is this kind of very posh celebby restaurant club in London. So he took editors out, and he just sold Matt Hilton's first book for, I think Matt sold for like £800,000 sterling, 5 book
deal. Oh, the good old days of publishing.
And the good old days, the good old days. Remember those? So he kind of, you know, buttered everyone up and, you know, kind of got everyone excited. And then the book went out to like maybe, I think, 6 or 7 publishers all on the same day. And I thought I'd tell the story because I always, before I sold, I loved hearing these stories. You know, it's felt like you're winning the lottery, which it kind of is. So the first thing we got asked, I remember it went out on like a Tuesday, and the first email I got on a Thursday, just for people who think publishing is about books. First email was, have you got a picture of them? Like, I'm not a big picture guy, right? I don't like having my photograph taken. So I kind of managed to get a picture. And then I realized actually years later, what I should have done was gotten like a picture of Gerard Butler or someone. Yeah. And I think I probably would have gotten like, you know,
more money.
Figures.
just to interrupt you there, it's really interesting you say that, because that's still happening. There are authors who, and it's terrible to say, but are clearly, there's so much more promotion around them because they are camera ready, or they're a certain age, or they're a certain level of attractiveness. And you're just wow, you know, some big deals for an attractive photo. So it's really interesting you say that's still going on.
I actually think that perhaps next time I send a book out, which I haven't done in years, but we send a book out wide to publishers, I might actually hire like a male model.
A fake
and
one.
Then, you know, rather than having ghostwriters who do the book for you, I'm going to have like someone, he can just go out and do
a
it. I'll
ghost
find
actor.
Someone that can, you know, construct a sentence. And they can go out and do all the press. But yeah, and that certainly comes into it. So the book went out, and then we, this is quite weird. I flew to London to meet with publishers. I got the first offer. I was out of the first meeting, I think, which was with a publisher called Headline. I came out of that meeting and got a phone call. And I think the first offer was kind of $120,000 for 3.
Which is a lot of people think it was good.
This doesn't make me look good, but I remember being absolutely gutted. I was just like, oh my God. Because I guess, again, because of Matt's deal, I'd kind of built it up in my head. And then we had like 4 publishers in. And then it was the classic great thing for an agent, you know, so he's kind of phoning them, you know, well, so-and-so's bid this and da-da-da. So we ended up, I think we ended at, I'll do the very un-British thing of giving you figures. We're not, I was, you know, my mother would have a fit if she knows I'm telling people, you know, discussing money. But I think we ended up at 350,000 sterling for 3 books, but world rights. World rights in English. Yeah. Actually, no, world rights, pretty much everything. And so that was just a kind of amazing experience. I got taken out to breakfast at the Woolsey, which is another kind of celeb place. And it's just, so I pretty much had like 5 minutes of being the most popular kid in school.
Oh,
right?
Wow. It's the dream. It's what every author dreams of.
It's absolutely amazing. But I always remember Zoe Sharp said early on, I read in an interview, fantastic writer, said when she got her first deal, she thought she'd won the lottery, but she'd won a lottery ticket. And look, you know, it's a lot of money. It's absolutely fantastic. It takes the pressure off, but then you have to have the sales to back it up. And we did. And also there's extra expectations on performance of the book to earn out. So the first book did really well. And then the second book came out. That did really well. Everyone was flying along. And then two things happened at once. My editor, who is a fantastic woman called Selena Walker, who's now at Penguin Random House, but was then at Transworld. So she decided, or she was being moved. I think Random House UK were not doing that well at that time. And they needed someone really dynamic like Selena to kind of come over. So I lost my editor. And that is... doesn't have to be, but very often is the kiss of death, because they're the person that's really advocating for you in the publishing house and pushing you. And the other thing you're running into is, well, they were publishing me. They're also publishing Lee Child and Julie Cooper and Dan Brown, you know. So, you know, you're up against some heavyweight competition. You know, people have absolutely earned their place and, you know, but they're going to get the attention. So she moved, and then I had to negotiate a new deal. And so this was about 2011. I think Sony had released their e-reader. I do remember buying it. I have to say I never used it. So what does that tell you? Like, I spent about £200 or €200 in Dublin Airport and bought it, and ended up, it was just too clunky. And then the Kindle was coming out. So what I did was, and I was reading Joe Conrath's blog, you know, that horrible, horrible Joe that... you know, told the truth that everyone hated, a terrible guy. And I was kind of reading that, and I've always been kind of, well, first of all, I did an economics degree, and I've always been kind of fairly business savvy, and I've always kind of kept up with tech stuff. So I just had a sense, and also similarly, I was going into meetings, and I remember famously going into one meeting at Transworld, and they said, oh yeah, ebooks, that's just not going to happen. And I can remember looking at the person that said to me, I was literally looking at him like this.
Yeah.
You're completely insane. You know, it was kind of, I think it was pretty obvious that when Amazon came out with the Kindle, because it was just so user-friendly, and is that, I always think technology that works is the kind of thing my mum can use. Like a TiVo for American people, or Sky Plus box, someone that people can use is going to work. So I had to sign a new deal. So what I said was, I'll sign a new deal. I will take much less of an advance, but you bought World. You haven't sold American rights. So I want North America and all the rights back from the first deal that you didn't sell. And they agreed.
Wow, that wouldn't happen anymore.
Yeah, no chance, right? So I can remember coming off the phone and literally like doing a jig around the kitchen, because I knew, or I had an inkling of what that was going to be worth to me. And I had a feeling it was going to be worth pretty much what the original deal was in the long term. So that was the story of living the trad dream and then moving to indie. And I have to say, there has not been a single day, even though I would do a trad deal again if the right deal came along, the right publisher, the right editor. I don't see it as sides in a war at all. So I absolutely would, but I'm just happier. Just happier.
And why do you think you're happier?
I think it's because I'm a control freak. You know, I'm all that tend to do well in indie, kind of, you know, they like to have, you know. Now, having said that, I mean, I got treated, you know, incredibly well. I got cover approval. I used to write the copy for the books. You know, like, I couldn't, you know, Selena Walker, an amazing editor, couldn't have been nicer to me. But there's still that thing of, if you want to do a promotion, you know, you still don't. And also, you really are restricted in terms of the types of stories you tell. And they want, I mean, when we went out with the first book to sell at auction, I mean, one of the publishers that passed said, if it had been just like Jack Reacher, we would have bought it. you know, so I would have, so that's kind of, you know, you're kind of dealing on the one side with the financial side and the economics of it. And the other side, you're dealing with the creative side. And you know, but in a way, what's been interesting about the journey is, I think more like there was times I had discussions with the with publishers, and I could tell they were frustrated with me, right? And now I get why they were frustrated with me when I said certain things, because I see it from the other side. You know, I see it from a publisher side as well.
I totally agree with you. And I think this is really interesting, because when indie kind of started really taking off back in 2011, people were just throwing stuff up and being quite unprofessional about things. But now the indie market is pretty mature. And many of us have these small publishing houses where we're putting out professional level books, you know, pricing higher, doing audio, doing, you know, special print editions. And I think things have very much changed since then. And you mentioned the intellectual property rights thing. So back in 2011, you did, you know, savvy deals, but you did say that you would still be interested in a deal now. So what would make it worth your while, do you think? Or let's put it another way. So for people listening, what would you advise? Like, what is a good deal with a traditional publisher right now? Is it, you know, for me, is it UK print only rights, for example, that type of thing?
I mean, it's a big topic. I think there's some things the publishers could do to kind of, if it is a war, they could end the war tomorrow. And I think the two things, the first thing they could do is move, as you do with foreign deals, to fixed term licensing.
Yeah.
So most foreign deals, it's like 4 years, 5 years, 7 years, and they have the book and they have to make their money in that time, and then the rights come back to whoever sold those rights, either a bigger publisher or the author. And then the other thing that really is a killer is non-compete clauses.
Yeah, just explain that for anyone who doesn't.
Okay, so no, it's non-compete clauses. Basically, they can be quite loose or quite restrictive. But so they say you can't publish another book within a certain time period. You can't publish another book using those characters. You know, there's all sorts of ways to, but basically, what it does is it means that you can't just go out and do what you want to do. Mm-hmm. You have to run it past them. So as I say, it can be quite restrictive. It can be quite loose. Now, we're going to get a little bit kind of intellectual property law here.
That's good.
The thing is, my wife, when I met her, she was working in IP law in Los Angeles in the film industry. So I kind of became kind of quite au fait with all this stuff early on, which has been a tremendous advantage to me, especially with the transition. I think in terms of ending all of this, I think fixed term licenses, rather than we get the book and you're never going to see it, those rights again. Because the thing is, you know, it used to be, Joanna, and you'll remember this, it used to be when it was print, if they stopped selling print copies, then maybe only sold 100 copies, you got those rights back.
Because they were out of print, which doesn't happen anymore. Because they were out of print.
Well, now it can never, you know, even if there's a low, you know, there's a floor, and they say, you know, we have to sell 500 ebooks. You know, there's nothing to stop them doing a flash sale for 99 pence or for 99 cents and making those sales, and they keep it.
Yeah. No, it's interesting. And then, of course, you mentioned your wife in LA and the law and Hollywood and things. And you're a screenwriter and you've written with TV as well. So, I mean, just coming back, and I think this is really interesting on traditional publishing. Do you think right now, because Amazon have just launched their charts as we talk in mid-2017. And what was very noticeable is pretty much all the books, well, not all of them, but a lot of the books in those top 20 were film adaptations or had been adapted into films. So my question there is, do you think people are more likely to get screenplay interest or TV, Amazon Studios interest if they are with a traditional publisher? Do you think
would that be one reason? Just because of how, you know, they don't have that many, but, you know, it used to be you had book scouts that would get manuscripts in the big publishing houses early. Mm. And I mean, my take on it is, if you want to go for like the Euro Millions lottery, you know, like win like 30 million, 50 million, well, chances are you're not going to win. But if you want to buy that ticket, you're going to probably go with a traditional publisher.
Mm. But if you want that long-term income every month, you're better to go in.
Just the fact that, you know, I mean, you look at what happened with 50 Shades. And 50 Shades was making good money for all those people. That's why there's been so many lawsuits afterwards. But they were making nice money. But no one has the kind of distribution kind of power and might of a Random House.
Mm.
Well, they just don't.
Yeah, and this is what's interesting to me. So I understand the, yay, I'm going to get a seven-figure deal with Random House or, you know, Penguin Random House or somebody big. Why are authors now taking digital-only deals with tiny houses? Like, do you know, what is that mindset? You know, well, how did you break out of that mindset, do you think?
Do you want me to answer that honestly?
Yeah, I do.
And I'll offend people. Listen, if you're offended by this, you can email me through the website or have a go at me on Facebook. I'm easy enough to find. If you're taking like a no advance or low advance digital only deal, you're an idiot.
I think the same. I don't understand why.
Because you have to ask. See, the thing is, the way the advance was explained to me, and it makes a lot of sense, you know, because I can remember when I published, there was an Australian author I knew who was like, I would have taken less of an advance if they'd put it into marketing. Well, they're not good. That ain't going to happen.
Like that. Mm.
And I would have done the same. Like, I would have given them, if they could have like said, oh, we're going to do this, we're going to do that and the other. If someone has a lot of money on the line, they're going to spend money to recoup it. You know, you see the same thing in the film business. I don't know if you follow the filmmaker Kevin Smith.
Mm.
Okay. He very famously, one of his last movies, he upset a lot of people because he made this movie called Red State. And he said he was going to show it at Sundance and he was going to live auction the movie to distributors at Sundance after it was screened, right? And he basically, it was very, very funny. It was a kind of Conrathian moment, shall we say, to bring Joe back into it. And he basically got up and he said, yeah, I'm going to buy the movie from myself for $5. And he just went on this rant about the movie industry. And he said, you know, what will happen is he spent like $2-3 million making the movie. So what he said was, you'll pay me like, you know, $3 million. So I'll make $1 million. He said, then you'll spend $20 million on marketing and I won't see any more than my $3 million. Because they do, you know, they do what they call net profit participation.
Mm.
And Eddie Murphy famously referred to them as monkey points.
Yes, I've heard this.
Because you'll never see that money. I have a friend, David Seidler, who wrote the movie King's Speech.
Oh, wonderful.
Which was, fantastically successful. But he actually had to take Harvey Weinstein to court to get his profit participation.
Mm.
So that movie made like $102 million, $200 million. Mm. As far as the studio were concerned, hadn't made a profit.
It is crazy. But I mean, this is all really awesome. But let's come back to indie, because I know people, you know, are really interested, particularly about indie books. Now, we were talking before the show, and you said, like, one of the great quote, different books take off in different formats at different times. So it's not like you came out of this big traditional publishing deal and every book you've put out since then has been just an amazing hit.
I've had some complete disaster.
So tell us about that.
Well, I'll tell you my biggest financial disaster, although I really enjoyed writing it, was I wrote a kid's book for my two of my little nieces called Extel Zybe Gruff in the 39th College. I thought, Joe Rowling, watch out. You know, here we go. And I think I probably spent more on the cover than that book's made.
Oh, they're expensive.
You know, so, I mean, it just, you know, it happens. It happens. Did I have a fun time writing it? Yeah. Did I do one book, which was really stupid, rather than doing three?
Series, yeah.
Yes, I did, because I'm stupid at times, just like people taking digital-only deals. I've just called you stupid. I'm stupid too. You know, I mean, the thing is with this business is we try stuff, don't we? Mm. You know, and I know you wanted to talk in a little bit about translations, and I've had stuff where I've paid for translations, and I'll make that money back in maybe 20, 30.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So it's just, you know, but it's kind of the fun part too, because you can, you're learning, you know, and I know it's kind of a bit of an old cliche in tech circles, but it is true. When you fail, you learn. Mm-hmm. And especially when you put your own money out there, like, you take that lesson on board. You know, you lose 2,000-3,000 euro or dollars, you've learned that lesson. Mm-hmm. But yeah, in terms of stuff working, so I've done two things recently that initially didn't work and then have really taken off. So the first one was I wrote a biography, very short biography, maybe 20,000 words of, and I know you, I sense you're going to be an expert on this, on the mixed martial arts fighter, UFC fighter, Conor McGregor. He's like the biggest star in Ireland, one of the biggest sporting stars among a certain demographic in the world. So that happened because I have an office in Dublin. I was getting the train in, and literally every young man and teenage boy under the age of 30, it was the only topic of conversation. Hmm. So I kind of got interested in it myself. I looked on Amazon, people had written biographies, but people do these Wikipedia scrape biographies. Mm. And it was really embarrassing. And so I thought, well, I'll write something about them, you know. And I wrote that and I put it out in ebook, tumbleweed, right? Nothing. I didn't really do it to make money. I did it because, you always have the hope that someone's going to take off. And then I had a publisher in London say, oh, we'd really like the print rights. And I said, well, okay, it's 20,000 words.
So it will be tiny if people don't know. Yeah. That's really tiny.
So, you know, so maybe like 90 pages. So they said, well, okay, we don't want the print rights. Would you like to write a full-length biography? So we went back and forth. And again, this is, you know, where publishers, you know, speed to market can be frustrating. And they finally made the deal. And the deal they offered me was so bad, I told my agent not to counter. I said, just don't reply. It's ridiculous. But what I did, they did me a huge favor. So I did a little Create Space edition. Mm. And I just went nuts over Christmas. Because it was all these teenage boys. I knew this because I saw the reviews where they said, little Aiden loves Conor McGregor. I didn't know what to buy him for Christmas. I saw this. I hope he likes it. So I made like 5,000-7,000 euro in the space of a couple of months.
Wow, that's amazing.
Right.
That's really good.
But that was like ebooks, tumbleweed. So the second example, I do a series with the wonderful, her official name is New York Times bestseller, Rebecca Cantrell.
Indeed, a regular on the show.
Contractually obligated to call her that in that order. So I did a series of books, called the Malibu Mystery, Sofia Salgado books. The first one was called A is for Asshat, which is now called A is for Actress.
Oh, really? Did you get complaints?
You can't get promo if you have the word ass in your book title. Like, they won't tell you. That's why they won't promo it. But that's why, like, Apple won't promo it. You know, and I love Apple, by the way.
Lessons learned.
So that came about because I had this idea about a former child star who plays a detective on TV who decides that she's going to join a real detective agency. Because I'm always kind of fascinated with this idea of fame, and everyone's so obsessed by it. And I thought, well, what would be the strangest thing would be someone who decides they don't want fame. Like, they've done it, they're not interested. Mm. So every time I spoke to Rebecca, she would say, what are you going to do? When are you going to write that series? Now, if there's anything I've learned over my 20-something years of marriage to an American woman, is that they're really good at getting you to do things. Like, they're genius. It probably applies to English women and, you know, all kinds
everyone
of women.
Else.
Everyone else. But, and I thought, well, if, so I said to Rebecca, well, why don't you write it with me? Because I knew if I said that, then I'd have to do it, you know? So we co-authored these books. So we've got A is for Actress, B is for Bad Girls. It's only 4 books, so it won't be a long plug. C is for Coochie Coo and D is for Drunk. And we thought, this is going to be great. It's the Janet Ivanovich audience. We had a blast writing them. They were like the most fun of anything I've written. And we just didn't sell any. Mm. It's just, you know, compared to what she would normally launch with her, you know, her series, and I would normally launch with the Ryan Locke books. It was awful. And so we thought, well, okay, but we still kept on every couple of months. Like, what? Well, we don't get it. Like, why aren't these books selling? Like, we kind of felt there was an audience. So we're very lucky. We landed a BookBub. We put them in Kindle Unlimited, so Kindle Select. So they're only available there at the moment. We did a free BookBub on the first one, and sales, it was just like they just took off. And so we're now scrambling to write the next 2 books in the series. But that's the thing about intellectual property and having all these. First of all, a book that works and might work in not work in ebook, but will work in print. Mm. Also, actually, with the Malibu books, where they were selling like crazy, even when we couldn't give away ebooks or print books, was the audio. Mm. We had this amazing, fantastic narrator who, by the way, completely lied about or slightly misled us about our age. She said, and she'll watch this, it'll be fine, she'll laugh. Because the main character's in her early 20s, and she sent us this picture that's not her, but her audition is so brilliant. It's coming back to
the photo again. Yeah, don't judge me.
Covers and pictures, isn't it? All these weird expectations we have and ageism. So something might not sell in one format, but it'll sell in another format, or maybe the time's just not right.
Mm.
You know, so you just don't know. You can have stuff sitting on your KDP dashboard, not moving, and then you write another book in that series.
Yeah, and I think, well, obviously the multiple books in a series is so important. I think if it's not working, do something else. Yes. So like, you know, pulling it and going in KDP Select, getting a BookBub, putting some ads on it, like that's really good. And the time isn't right. Now, coming back to translations, this is what I feel about translations. Right. I feel that the market for digital, for ebooks, which is where indies can make money, is not mature in any other language right now. It's only like in French, I think it's 0.1% of French books are sold digitally or something like that. Like, don't quote me, but you know, tiny French market. A German market is probably is the biggest one after English, but still, you know, still there's a lot more print sales in Germany than ebooks. So do you think, like, and I've, just so everyone knows, I pulled my translations, paid off my translators, and now
I read that.
Yeah, it was painful, but also important. I had done joint venture deals with them. So, you know, they had expected to make money. Neither of us were. The translators weren't really able to market. And that's the biggest issue, is marketing in these other languages. Yeah. So, and even things like, there's no BookBub in German and no BookBub in French. So do you think with translations, like you say, you're out of pocket, but do you think in 5 years' time, for example, you're going to see those books start to sell?
I'm making money now in one market, which is Italy.
Interesting. Because that's tiny.
I'm slightly scattergun. So I probably would be a rotten publisher. I'd probably be, you know, if I had some company's money rather than my own money and someone saying, honey, where's the mortgage payment? You know, I spent it on translation. I'd probably be out of business pretty quickly because I just like to try stuff.
Mm.
So I have about 4 or 5 books in Italian via Babel Cube, which I know not everyone's a fan. I actually think that contract is a fantastic deal for authors.
Really?
I'll tell you why. Because after 5 years, the author owns the translation in that contract.
Wow.
And it's shared risk. So I've done a bunch of translations of varying quality. The Italian ones, I have to say, are excellent. I know they're excellent because they sell. Right.
Yeah.
And it was just one of those things where I had them on Babel Cube. You know, I used the same cover, so I just got my cover designer, I changed the title. And I started getting royalty statements from Babel Cube, and I was like, oh, this is quite interesting now. You have my attention.
Hmm. These are fiction.
Yeah, these are the Ryan Locke series.
Wow.
So the main series in Italian. And I think this month's, again, being crude and talking about money, sorry, Mom. This month's royalties is about €700.
Wow. How many books?
I quite like, you know, the Dean W. Smith thing about the magic cake shop? Wesley Smith, yeah. So his whole thing is a book is a cake, right? And so you sell the cake, but especially with ebooks and digital, the cake, you don't have to bake another cake. So I look at it as like a kind of multi-channel, international cake shop. So you bake one cake, but you have really about potentially maybe 400 or 500, you know, different variations of that cake because, you know, you have print ebook, you have audio. I think my Conor McGregor book proved it. If you have something that works, and I know people like Hugh Howey, he made a bunch of money on print.
Mm, oh, he sold so, and he licensed his print only to big publishers.
Mm. No, but I think he actually said that he was looking forward to getting those print rights back because he was making the same money himself, as I recall. Someone will correct me if I'm wrong. So you have those channels, and then if you look at it by country, you have all those channels replicated in all those territories. Now you are absolutely correct in terms of reach and distribution. You know, we're nowhere near, especially with ebooks. I think partly because countries like France. I think partly it's literary culture. I would imagine there's also governmental and state and lobbying by publishers. You know, that stuff doesn't work as well in the States. You know, the States much more for good or ill, you know, and as far as I'm concerned, a lot of time it's for good. You know, it's rampant capitalism, isn't it?
Yeah. You know?
Which is if
great
you're
for
on
us.
The right side of that equation is no bad thing, you know?
Yeah, no. I think that's a really good point. And I'm really interested in what's happened with Babel Cube. I have heard some really bad stories. So let's just warn everyone, buyer beware.
Quality may vary. I would say read the contract, really check your translator. Mm. You know, find even if you have to pay someone to check the translation, then do that. Although I think I do have a couple of translations floating around that maybe aren't the best, but it's a 5-year deal, you know.
Exactly.
I'm much happier with Babel Cube than I am say with ACX. You know, ACX slash the royalties. And I loved ACX. You know, and I think they do a fantastic job, but they're really in a monopoly position.
Yep.
I hope someone comes along and gives them a run for their money because I think taking 60% is greedy. You know, it's greedy. And I'm the one that likes to be greedy. I don't know all these other people being greedy. I've got a family. I've got a mortgage here. But yeah, so Babel Cube, I would say look at the people that have said negative things about them. I have to say I have not had, you know, like they pay royalties. It's a sliding scale, which I think it should be. So the translator gets the bulk of the money up to a certain sales level. I think it's $2,000. Mm. That's absolutely the way it should be because, I mean, that's a ton of work.
Yeah.
But, you know, but the converse side of that for me is I've already written that book. You know, that's the nice, that's why I don't, like, if stuff like that doesn't perform, I don't feel, and it's a royalty share, I'll feel bad for the other person, but I don't feel bad for myself because I literally had to send them a file.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I think that's really interesting. I mean, you and I could talk for ages, and I want to keep picking your brain, but we're pretty much out of time. And there's one question that's really super important to talk about, which is you and I are both finalists for the International Thriller Writers
Best. Yes. Congratulations.
Oh, congratulations to you. Best ebook original, my book, Destroyer of Worlds, and your book, The Edge of Alone, and a number of other books that we don't need to mention.
They're excellent books.
All excellent. I have got them all and I've started reading them all. I'm just checking out the competition. This will be announced the week after this show goes out. And we don't know right now who's going to win. Okay. It's next month, but as we're talking, obviously I'm going to win. But hey.
I have a very bad history with, let me reassure you here, right?
Yeah.
When I wrote for TV, There was one year I was nominated for Royal Television Society Awards, right? And I was nominated for two shows, a TV show in the UK called Biker Grove.
Oh, I remember that.
Yeah, and before anyone asks, this won't make any sense to anyone outside the UK. No, I did not. I was, Ant and Dec were before my time. We're about the same age. But so I was up for that and I had an original pilot show that was on ITV. And so I had two shows nominated and I was up in like five categories, right? And it's a big awards do and you have to dress up and blah, blah, blah. I won nothing.
I've got to ask you, how does it feel to be nominated and not win? Because that may well happen.
I would imagine if it's just once, it's okay. If you're sitting there through an entire awards show and you lose five times. I mean, by the end, I was thinking, surely just for the sake of, I've been on awards juries, surely just for the sake, I'll just give them something, you know, just, we can't have them not winning anything.
But what I want to ask you is, because this is the first time I've been a finalist in an award, and it means it does mean a surprising amount to me because, as you know, it's judged by authors. It's not about sales. And in fact, Destroyer of Worlds doesn't sell that many because it's about India. And a lot of people aren't that interested in books about India in America, surprisingly. But I think what's interesting is it all about ego as winning an award, or does it actually help sell books? Is it something?
Oh, this business is all about ego, Joanna. It's all about, of course it is. Everything's ego. Why would anyone assume that someone else wanted to read their story?
Yeah, I suppose so. So awards literally are all about ego.
I mean, I know from Rebecca Cantrell, my New York Times best-selling co-author.
Who won it last year, right?
She won it last year. And she's won, like, everything going. She's won, but like, just a tie. If you look at her up, she's won everything. And I think she said to me it didn't make that much of an impact sales-wise.
Hmm. Do you think that sort of coming full circle back to traditional publishing, because I am actually going to be pitching some screenplays and things at ThrillerFest, do you think that it does make the industry more interested?
Yeah, it probably does. Yeah. I mean, I think it's something to open with. I mean, I get asked a lot because I worked in primarily television for 10 years. I get asked about, you know, and people are always, when Lockbook's going to be a movie? It's nothing I think about. Mm. I mean, I'll tell you, you know, I mentioned him earlier, David Seidler with The King's Speech. I was probably one of the first people to read that script. And everyone turned that script down. Mm. Everyone. The way he got that movie made was that he had one of the actors commit, and then he had Tom Hooper, who became the director. His mother happened to be at a reading of it in London and phoned him.
So pure luck.
That was the reason that movie got made. So I don't get too excited. I think I do what's really nice about the ITW just being nominated. And I can actually say this now and actually mean it and be sincere, is being nominated by your peers is really nice. Mm. I mean, it really is. It's touching, you know, and I know people mostly say that, and what they mean is, but I'd better win. But I mean, I genuinely, because those are our contemporaries.
Yeah.
And also The Edge of Alone was a bit of a disaster release for me, because I think the wrong file went out on Kindle the first time it went out. And so there was typos. I got battered in the reviews. And it was, and until I got that nomination at that, you know, you have favorite children. You know, well, I only have one.
And I don't have any.
That's fine, so it's easy. But, you know, but people have favorite children. That was not my, it was weird because it was a book I loved, I felt was good. The Lock readers did not like that book. Mm. Just didn't like it. Mm.
It'd be interesting. So, well, I hope that I win or you win. How's that?
I can hope you win too. I can hope, you've talked me into hoping you win now.
Oh, excellent. But it is interesting because it does mean more because it's nominated by authors. Like, that we're finalists because authors read our books.
So they know, they know how difficult it is. Because, I mean, that's the other thing is, you know, for all the, six-figure deals and blah, 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 and stuff that works and stuff that doesn't work. I mean, you know, you're at your desk on your own thinking, I'm going to be found out now.
Mm, yeah.
I mean, I don't write books where I'm thinking, oh, this is, whoa, oh my, what a guy, you know, this is amazing.
No, we all suffer that self-doubt.
Yeah.
But we're going to have to go. Okay. I definitely could talk to you all day. We'll have to have a return match.
Yes, we'll do.
That would be awesome.
A rematch. It could be interesting, depending. Maybe someone else should win.
No.
Maybe someone else should win.
James Scott Bell is also nominated. He's been on the show as well.
He's a cracking writer.
We love Jim.
I mean, they're all great. They're all terrific writers and terrific books. Mm. But I guess so. We'll see. If you win or I win, this could be a little bit tense.
I doubt it. Right. So tell us where people can find you and your books online.
Okay, so there's the Ryan Locke series. That's available all the usual places, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Google, Kobo, all those good places. You can buy print, you can get the audio. The Byron Tiber series, two books in that. One of those was also ITW nominated. See, I've lost once already, so I'm battle hardened. And that's available same places. Malibu Mystery series, starting with A is for Actress with Rebecca Cantrell. That's available online. And then there's my website, which is seanblackauthor.com. And you can also have a go at me on Facebook if you've signed a digital-only deal and object to what I said.
Fantastic. Well, thanks so much for your time, Sean. That was
great. Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure and a privilege.
I hope you enjoyed the interview with Sean today. I certainly had a laugh, and he'll be a repeat guest for sure. Unless he wins the International Thriller Writer Prize, of course, in which case I'll never speak to him again. So next week, I'm talking about how to write fast, publish slowly, and focus your author marketing with Rachel Aaron, who is a fantasy author and also wrote 2K to 10K, which many of you will know in terms of productivity and writing speed. But actually, Rachel's got some different thoughts to what I expected. So that's really interesting. So listen in next week and remember to pick up your copy of How to Market a Book 3rd edition this week if you want to sell more books and reach more readers. Available 6th of July 2017 in ebook and print editions on all the usual stores or thecreativepen.com/books. You can always find the links there. Right. Happy writing and creating and publishing and marketing week, and I'll see you next time. Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. You might also like the backlist episodes and show notes, available at thecreativepen.com/podcast. You can also get your free author blueprint at thecreativepen.com/blueprint. If you'd like to connect, you can tweet me at The Creative Pen or find me on Facebook at The Creative Pen. See you next time.